speaking with Andrew Solomon, whose new book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew, you spent 11 years working on this book. You interviewed more than 300 families who have what you call exceptional children. You talked with dwarfs and people who are deaf and families who've been profoundly changed by Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia. You've even talked with parents whose children have committed murder. What were you trying to figure out?
I was very struck by the idea that there are many kinds of identity that are passed down from generation to generation. And those tend to be reinforced. People develop a positive relationship with their ethnicity, their nationality, frequently their religion. And then there are these other identities which occur to people whose parents have no previous experience with them. So it came out of my experience of being the gay child of straight parents, but I wanted to look at the fact that most deaf people are born to hearing parents, most dwarfs are born to parents of average height, most criminals are born to parents who haven't committed crimes, and so on and so forth. So I found 10 of those categories, and I really wanted to look at how identity gets constructed for people who have families who frequently want to cure or make go away the conditions that those people end up finding some value in. And I wanted to look at the tension between experiencing any of these things as an illness and experiencing it as an identity.
So you're talking about profound differences between parents and their children.
I am talking about profound differences, though my belief is that by studying those profound differences, we illuminate the experience of all parenting, which is that your child sometimes seems to have come from a faraway alien place and you can't imagine why they are the way they are.
You know, I can imagine that some people would not like these kinds of comparisons that you seem to be making. I mean, for instance, someone who's deaf might not want to be compared to a schizophrenic or an autistic person. You might be offended by comparisons to families with parents whose kids have committed murder. Do they really have something in common?
They have a lot in common, and it was actually the surest sign that I was onto something, that everyone in the book is offended by the other chapters. I mean, the deaf people all feel like, okay, but we're not, we're have intelligence that people with Down syndrome don't. The people with schizophrenia say, but we aren't actually committing crimes. The people who commit crimes say, all right, but we're not as strange as those people who are transgender. There's a sort of sense that everyone has a bit of a hang up about the others. What I found is that each of these individual differences, taken one by one, siloed, is quite isolating. There are only so many families dealing with autism. There are only so many families dealing with Down syndrome. There are only so many families with children who are prodigies or bringing up children conceived in rape. If you look at all of these experiences together, however, you find out that what you're talking about is actually the majority of humanity, that the majority of humanity is bringing up at some point or is related to in some way someone who is different in a fundamental fashion from the rest of the family. And if you look at that universal experience or nearly universal experience of dealing with difference within the family, suddenly the people in all of these separate groups aren't so isolated.
You write about how the subject for this book, in a way, came out of your own personal experience. You're gay, and it sounds like, from the way you write about this, you had a pretty tough time growing up, but not just the ostracism that you felt from your peers at school, but from your own parents.
Yes, I think it was difficult for my parents and it was difficult for me. But when I was growing up, in the first place, gayness was seen as an illness, a sin, and a crime. But it was also understood that gay people were cut off from many of the meaningful experiences of life. They didn't have family. They were less likely to have a relationship. They were socially marginalized. It was a disreputable thing to be. And the world has changed so profoundly. In 1966, Time magazine, when I was 3 years old, ran an article in which they said, even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life that deserves no glamorization and no treatment as anything but what it is, a pernicious sickness.
Wow. You said that was what, 1960s?
66,
wow,
yes.
Things certainly have changed since then.
And I've actually memorized the passage, as you'll tell, because it just was so shocking to me when I came upon it. And now we live in a world in which the President of the United States has just filed a brief in support of gay marriage with the Supreme Court. So if we look at that seismic shift And we look at how difficult it was for my parents to accept the idea that I might be gay in that context, and how much easier it's been for my father — my mother is sadly deceased — but for my father to accept my being gay in the modern world, or the world that we now inhabit. I was very interested in how those shifts take place, and I wondered a lot about for whom else those shifts could take place. But to your question, I was bullied as a child, and I did have parents who, I mean, they never rejected me or threw me out of the house or anything, but they thought it would be better if I were straight, and they're thinking that was a very heavy burden on me, and I went to considerable lengths trying to be straight. I mean, I had girlfriends, I went to see sexual surrogates, I was involved in all kinds of activity to try to make myself be straight, and I got to the point at which I could pass for being straight, and then I thought, but that's not who I am and not what I want to do. So I had to discover the identity, really, for me when I was in my 20s.
It sounds like part of the piece of your own story that then has fed into this book that you've just written is the complicated relationship you had, particularly with your mother, who didn't really accept who you were.
You know, I've talked in the book about the idea that I have dyslexia, and that when I was very little, my mother spent thousands of hours sitting with me on her lap, helping me learn to read. And I ended up being a reader. I ended up writing books. So even though you can't make dyslexia go away, she gave me a lot of coping mechanisms that allowed me to get around it. And I did very well with words and with letters. That was fantastic. But I think her sense that it was possible to resolve that doubtless fed into her belief that it was possible, likewise, to resolve the homosexuality, that that was somehow just another neurological abnormality and we could all triumph over it. I always remember the episode, which I've written about, when I was in a shoe store when I was little, and as we were leaving, the salesman said, "And I'll give each of you a balloon," he said to my brother and me. "What color balloon would you like?" And my brother wanted a red balloon, and I said I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said, "Actually, I think you'd like the blue balloon." And I said, "No, I really want the pink balloon." And she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. And the fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence, I think, of my mother's influence and its limits. She was fighting against this from the very beginning. There were signs of it from the very start. She found it very difficult to deal with. But as I say, she didn't throw me out of the house. She didn't stop speaking to me. She just wished things were otherwise. And she wished they were otherwise for two reasons, which were difficult to disentangle, but which were both there. One of which is that she thought it was going to be a sad, lonely life for me. And one of which was that she felt that she didn't want to be the mother of a gay child. It interfered with her sense of perfectionism in her own life.
So you're raising some big issues here. I mean, one is acceptance. I mean, what does it take for a parent to accept a child who is fundamentally different? I mean, that's kind of the through line of a lot of these stories that you tell. What does it take?
Well, I think a lot of the time people make the mistake, and I myself made it in relation to my own parents, of conflating acceptance and love. I think that my parents always loved me, but they didn't always accept me. And having looked at all of these families and looked at what they've been through, I realized accepting that your child is different from you is difficult for every single parent who faces it. Some get through the acceptance quickly. For some, it takes longer. Some never get there at all. And of course, some parents don't actually love their children. There are neglectful and abusive and horrific parents out there. My experience is that most parents love their children, but many of them struggle with accepting their children. So I tried to tease apart those two things. And acceptance, really, of any of these conditions has to come at three levels. The individual has to achieve self-acceptance, family acceptance, and the acceptance of the larger society. And they all influence one another. So if your family accepts you, your self-acceptance may come more readily. But if you've truly accepted yourself, sometimes that's an effective way of converting your parents. Sometimes not, but sometimes it is. When families cease to mourn over having children who have these particular differences, the larger society becomes more open and more tolerant. I just this week was down in Texas visiting people, and there was a conversation at dinner one night about how the son of one of the prominent citizens in the relatively small city where I was had come out of the closet as gay, and how the more that that happened, the easier it was for people who weren't from such prominent families and who weren't so visible to come out as gay. I think there's a sense that acceptance is achieved on the broadest level by working at the same time on self-acceptance, family acceptance, and social acceptance.
Let's talk about some of the stories that you tell in your book, because a lot of them are remarkable. And, I mean, it's one thing to say that yes, parents should accept their children. It's another thing when you actually talk about some of the particular circumstances, some of the incredibly difficult circumstances. For instance, you write about a family who had a severely autistic child who's spoken, what, only four times in her life?
Yes. Betsy Burns is the mother, and Jeff Hansen is the father, and their daughter is named Cece. And really, Cece, when she was about four, I think it was, at one point said, I'm trying to remember now the order of the quotes that she came up with, someone turned the lights off and she said, I want the lights on. She had never said a word before then, and her parents sat there and thought, wow, what's coming next? And then she didn't say anything for years. And then when she was about 8 or 9 years old, there was a puppet show going on at school, and someone said, what color is the king's cloak? And she said, it's purple. And then nothing for years. And then one time she was watching TV with the family and one of them turned off the television and she said, I want the television on.
Wow. You, I mean, mother, you have, the parents have to be wondering, why in the world did she speak at this particular time?
At those times. But what they also are wondering is, if she has the capacity to speak and to be responsive to a specific situation, then how can she... how can her mind be working all of the time when she doesn't speak? Are the words in there, but she can't produce them? What is the extent of her language comprehension? What is the extent of these expressive abilities? And could we ever free her so that she were able to speak more of the time? That's the struggle and the confusion for a family like that. A child who never talks and who appears not to be connected to the world of language at all presents a set of challenges. But a child who's spoken four times presents a very different set of challenges and is, in a way, a more daunting thing to deal with because you have the sense not only of what you don't know, but of the extent of what you don't know.
So how do these parents, how have these parents handled the situation?
Well, it's been a very long and difficult situation. Her father is an accomplished writer, and so is her mother. They've both tried to write about their experience with her in various ways. They've tried to make sense of it, but they've both also dealt with depression, and they've both gone through very difficult times when they were, her mother was hospitalized several times. They've gone through a lot. Now, perhaps the mother would have been hospitalized with depression anyway, but I think the frustration and the stress and the expense and the exhaustion of dealing all the time with this child was enormous. And they finally had to put her in a group home because she was unmanageable and they were afraid she was going to strangle her younger sister as she tried to do on more than one occasion. But the guilt and the sadness attached to that were enormous. But she's in the group home now and doing well enough for someone like that. But who knows what her inner life is.
So coming back to that question then of accepting your child, accepting a child who is so radically different from you, loving your child, how have they come to terms with those words and all that those words mean?
Well, I loved it that her mother said, Cece is the ultimate Zen lesson. What is it like being Cece? Being Cece. And what does Cece think? She thinks what she thinks. She's accepted the unknowability, and she's accepted that this is who her daughter is, and she's accepted the great sadness that's attached to the sense of not having been able to do much good for her daughter as a mother. And she's accepted that her daughter has to live in and will always have to live in some kind of an assisted living facility or a group home. She's accepted it with enormous sadness and a tremendous sense of loss.
Another subculture you write about is the deaf community, and you kind of delved into that. And what's fascinating about this, and there are somewhat different issues, is that many deaf people do not consider their lack of hearing to be a problem. In fact, they reject the whole illness metaphor. They don't see that they have any kind of defect that needs to be cured. Many of them don't want cochlear implants that would give them some sense of hearing. What did you find out when you, as you got to know this community?
We live in a sort of ironic moment in which we have two kinds of progress that are taking place simultaneously. One is the progress toward arriving at medical cures for all kinds of illnesses, and the other is the progress toward arriving at social acceptance of all kinds of identities. And the deaf have found themselves more explicitly in that crossroads than almost anyone else. We have cochlear implants now. They work for most kinds of deafness, though not all kinds of deafness. It's a device that gets surgically implanted and that allows people to have a facsimile of hearing. It bypasses the actual cochlea of the ear, which is what's damaged in most deafness. So we have the implant. There's been this enormous medical breakthrough. But at the same time, we have a world of people who feel not that they lack hearing, but that they have membership in a rich community. So I spent time in deaf clubs. I spent time at the deaf theater. I went to the Miss Deaf America contest. I heard people, or rather saw people who were performing deaf poetry. And it's not my world, and I didn't especially want to join it, but it is a very vivid, very potent world. It seemed to me to have just as much validity and just as much of a sense of intrinsic community as the Latino community or the Jewish community or the New England community or whatever other communities one wants to come up with. It was a community. It was a part of the social world. And a lot of the deaf people who are culturally deaf, who live in the society united by the use of sign language, feel as though the cochlear implants are robbing them of their next generation. One of the people I interviewed was describing the loneliness he felt when he imagined a world in which there would be no more people like him. The culture is more widely accepted. Sign language is now one of the most taught languages in American universities. The interest in deaf culture has increased at the same time that medicine means there are fewer and fewer people who are functionally deaf. I've said it's like those moments in grand opera when the hero realizes he loves the heroine right as she's expiring on the sofa.
So are there similar issues then in terms of parent-child relationships? Let's say if the parents are hearing and the child is deaf?
Yes, most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Those hearing parents, by and large, feel that their children will need to function in the mainstream hearing world. They often work very hard with those children on lip reading and on oral speech. This is when there isn't a cochlear implant in the picture. And then at some point in adolescence, those deaf kids find a community of other deaf people and they learn sign language and they're enormously liberated. That's the narrative that seemed to me to be so parallel to the gay narrative of having parents, as I did myself and as many gay people do, who really want their children to function, be part of the straight world and keep trying to get them to do that. And then finally the kids discover their gayness and it comes as a liberation. Of course, now with the advent of the cochlear implant, a lot of the deaf children are not actually growing up with that difficult oral education based on working with audiologists and so on. They're using the cochlear implant and developing speech much the way that other people without hearing loss do. But there is still no question that it's the parents who are making the decision. The parents have a child and they by and large don't think, will my child have a happier life as a member of the deaf culture or as a member of the hearing world? They just assume that it's better to have a child who is like them. And they assume that deafness is a disability and a deficit and entirely a disability and a deficit. And they get those children implants. Now, I get asked sometimes, would you get implants if you had a child who were deaf? And I think I probably would because I'm not very good at languages. I don't think I would achieve enough fluency in sign and I would hate to have a child with whom I couldn't communicate. But do I, even as I say that, recognize that if everyone gets cochlear implants and that deaf culture I witnessed disappears from the face of the world, that would be a catastrophic loss? It would be a loss. It would be a real sadness for that culture to vanish from among us.
Hmm. As you were doing all of this research, I mean, interviewing hundreds of people, was there a moment of revelation for you when you, I don't know, came to see things in a new way, maybe came to see that what you had previously considered alien was not so alien anymore?
You know, there were many moments of revelation as I went along, but I think I chose the topics in part because I have a counterphobic tendency to rush toward things that frighten me. And I started off feeling ill at ease with all of these other kinds of difference. The deaf people made me anxious, disabled people made me uncomfortable, criminals I certainly wasn't going to feel like I was able to relate to, and so on. And as I talked to these people and talked to their families and heard everyone's stories, I felt that I had so much in common with all of these people. And I think the revelation came halfway through and then became that central argument of the book about how all of these experiences have a lot in common. I thought, the experience I had as a gay person gives me something in common with all of these people.
So you did not go into the book thinking that. I mean, I'm actually kind of surprised that you say that.
I think I went into the book thinking that I had a certain amount in common with the deaf, because I had done an article about deaf culture for the New York Times about 20 years ago. And I thought it would be interesting to see how much I had in common with people in these other cultures, but I didn't expect to feel it so deeply. I expected it to be an intellectual construct. And instead, I ended up feeling a kind of embracing connection to people who had conditions that I would have found incredibly alien and incredibly distant and different from my own experience.
Hmm. One of the most remarkable stories in your book is your conversations with the parents of Dylan Klebold, one of the two boys who carried out the Columbine massacre. I mean, you say these were good parents as far as you can tell.
You know, historically, we used to blame parents for their children's autism. That was caused by refrigerator mothers. We used to blame parents for children being gay. It was overbearing mothers and passive fathers. If you go back a couple of hundred years, we used to blame parents for children's dwarfism and deformity, which were the expression of the mother's lascivious longings, and so on and so forth. There's been this long history of blaming families. We don't do it in most of those areas, but we still do it all the time with families of people who commit crimes. We assume that somehow the family must have created the criminality, must have known about the criminality, must have somehow enabled it.
And or neglect, or neglectful enough that they didn't see the signs that they should have.
And it is true that parents who are profoundly neglectful or who are abusive can exacerbate the criminal tendencies in their children. But it's also true that a lot of kids come out committing crimes of households in which that was unacceptable behavior. And I ended up thinking that that criminality sometimes reflected a brokenness that was no more the responsibility or the fault or within the ken of the parents than it would be if they had any of the other conditions described in the book. And with the Klebolds, I went out to their house thinking, when I really get to know these people, I will understand what happened. And the better I got to know them, the less I understood it. I felt like they were people I would have been happy to have as my own parents if my actual parents hadn't been available. I mean, they're kind, they're intelligent, they're humane. And I've spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with them now. And very, very moving the way they've responded to their situation. I mean, I always remember after our first long weekend of interviews, we had recorded maybe 20 hours. We were sitting in the kitchen. Sue was fixing dinner, and I said to them, if Dylan were here now, do you have anything you'd want to ask him? And his father said, I sure do. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And Sue sort of stopped, and she looked at the floor for a minute, and then she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why
it was humbling. Yeah. And a few years later, we were having dinner in Denver, and I said to her, you know, tell me what you're thinking now. And she said, you know, she said, I used to think if I'd never gone to Ohio State, I wouldn't have met Tom. We wouldn't have had Dylan. This terrible thing wouldn't have happened. She said, and I used to wish for that. But over time, I've come to think that I love the children I had so much that I don't want to imagine a life without them. So while I recognize that it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided that it would not have been better for me. And I thought that level, we've talked about acceptance, that level of acceptance of someone who had done something horrific, not an acceptance of what he'd done, but an acceptance of him as the person she loved, was very profound. And while most of the conditions I was looking at are very different in nature from Columbine, the Columbine massacre, but still, that thing of sort of eventually working your way around to thinking, I didn't want to have a child with deafness or dwarfism or Down syndrome or schizophrenia, but I love my own child so much that I'm not going to wish for a different life that doesn't include that child. That I heard over and over again in one form or another.
Hmm. So interesting. You know, there's another category of parent-child relationships that you include in this study, which is really interesting. It's children who are prodigies. I mean, four-year-olds who are brilliant, just sort of doing off-the-map kinds of things that the parents can't really comprehend. And you say that's a real challenge as well. I mean, comparable to some of these other kinds of families we've been talking about.
So the point I wanted to make is that what's difficult is having a child who's different. Having a child who's different in a so-called positive way is not as sad as having a child who's different in a so-called negative way, but it's equally difficult. And much as it can be a burden to have the mind of a 5-year-old in the body of a 40-year-old, it can be very difficult to have the mind of a 40-year-old in the body of a 5-year-old. What happens with those children a lot of the time is that they have no peers. The people who are interested in the emotional life of a 5-year-old are 5, and they have no idea what the kid is talking about. And the people who understand the kid's intellectual interests really aren't going to be very keen on socializing with a 5-year-old. And so they experience a lot of isolation. And these families are cast, like the other families in the book, in the frustrating situation of having somehow to care for a child who's beyond their comprehension. They have to learn a whole new vocabulary, a whole set of skills. They have to figure out how to support this child. Many prodigies go through emotional difficulties. They have to see how they can steer those off at the pass. It's tough. As I say, it's not as sad as it might be to have a child with some of the other conditions, but it's not any easier.
I'm wondering what kind of conclusions you came to after you talked with all of these people. You've already talked about the importance of acceptance, but I guess I'm wondering why some parents are able to accept while others cannot.
The conclusion I came to is that it has a great deal to do with finding meaning. And the phrase finding meaning is a little tricky because it sounds as though the meaning is always there and some parents find it and other parents don't find it. I think the meaning is in some large part constructed. Do I really believe that Sue Klebold wouldn't have had a better life if she'd had other children or if other things had happened to her? No, I believe that she would have had a better life if she hadn't been the mother of the perpetrator of the Columbine massacre. But I think her ability to construct a narrative in which she decided that she so loved her child that she doesn't want to imagine another child gave her the strength to get through the difficult situation she was in and the strength to forgive her son for who he was and for what he did, not in terms of its influence on others, but in terms of its influence on her. There was one mother who described how difficult it was to deal with her children, who both had very severe multiple disabilities. One of them was left in a bathtub by a caretaker at the group home where he was living, and he drowned. And at his funeral, his mother said, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted and once of the son I loved." And I think it's discovering that love for a child you didn't want that can be the strong experience. And some people find meaning by assuming that they have a religious basis for it. God didn't give this to them for any reason other than that they would be able to deal with it. But many people just find the meaning within themselves. They say, "I've grown and I've been stretched and I've changed because of this." I mean, I think, for instance, of Tom and Karen Robards, who have a son with Down syndrome. They ended up getting involved in educational policy for people with Down syndrome and having a very significant effect and setting up a center for such education. And I said to them, "This has been so central to your life. Do you regret it? Do you wish it had never happened? Do you wish you'd never heard of Down syndrome?" And his mother said, "Well, for my son, I regret it because for my son, it's a difficult way to be in the world. And I'd make it go away in an instant because it would give him a happier life." She said, "But speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed I would say this 23 years ago when he was born. Speaking for myself, it's made me a better, richer person, and I wouldn't exchange it for anything." And I thought that point of view of embracing the life that you have over an imagined life that you might have had, that to me was the essence of resilience in these families.
Well, and it's such a profound thing to say. I mean, that basically it's through the hardship, through the suffering in some way that your life has become more meaningful and perhaps that your love has become deeper too.
Yeah. I mean, I see even with my own children who don't have any obvious special needs, at least so far, that, you know, it's the moments of comforting them when they're in tears in which the bonding really happens. It's great running around outside and playing games, and it's definitely a piece of it. But I think a lot of the intimacy of parenting comes of nursing your children through difficulty of one kind or another, and that if you had a child who never experienced any adversity or any difficulty, it would be a very different relationship than the universal experience that there is difficulty. These people represent a much greater extreme of that. And of course, they wish away the difficulty that their children are experiencing. But they nonetheless, in negotiating that difficulty, they form sometimes a bond that was overwhelmingly powerful.
So coming back to your own story that we started talking about, the fact that, you know, you're gay, your parents, particularly your mother, had a hard time accepting that when you were much younger. I think my impression is that you were pretty angry at her for a long time. I'm wondering if you've been able to let go of that anger. I mean, have you forgiven her in a way?
I said in the book that I started the book to forgive my parents, and in fact, I think it was very effective at that. I understood that acceptance is always difficult. I understood that acceptance is different from love, and I understood that my parents had loved me all the way through, my mother had loved me all the way through, and had eventually accepted me, and that that was perhaps as much as I could demand, and that there was something a little immature about thinking that she should accept me for exactly who I was from the very beginning with never a question asked. So I loved my mother enormously. She died almost 22 years ago. She remains very much present in my mind and in my life in various ways. I loved her, but I also felt that we had a very deeply enmeshed relationship which contained some poisonous elements. And now they just don't seem poisonous anymore. I can look back at them and think, it's too bad that she had that point of view, or it's too bad we struggled with this or that, but I no longer feel the sense of betrayal and despair and so on that I felt about those things when I was in my teens.